police. How are the police force changing? Are they really here to keep us safe? And what function will they have in the future? In this episode of Tipping Points, I speak with a retired Metropolitan Police Detective Sergeant who has since been on the side of activists. Paul Stevens has helped to liaise with protests by Extinction Rebellion and has appeared on LBC and Good Morning Britain to try to get the message across that protesting is a necessary and vital part of the survival of our civilization. Welcome.
Hi, Peter.
I wonder if you could tell me about what your perceptions of the police were before you started, and did your experience in those first few years match your expectations?
Both my granddads were police officers, one in Cornwall, one in London, but for a very short time. But it meant that I grew up trusting my granddad, and he was a policeman, so that's all right, you know. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. That's not very good for the climate, but that's what I wanted to be when I was young. I was in the air cadets, got a flying scholarship, got my pilot's license. So when you do that, you kind of, they try to see if you're suitable for the RAF, flying somewhere that the government decides needs to be bombed into non-existence is not my idea of a job, really. My second thing was joining the police, and I joined the police. As a bit, you know, I was 19 years old, and you want to do the right thing, and you think it's going to be an exciting job, and you know, you grew up with Starsky and Hutch, and and it's good against evil. I mean, it's all very naive and simplistic, but you are at that age, and that's why I joined the police, to try and do some good. And as I progressed through the police, I wanted to get in CID very quickly, Criminal Investigation Department. So then I got onto Murder Squad, beside a team of detectives on a local borough. You want to do the right thing, and you want to catch the bad guys, if there is such a thing. And it takes a long time to realise that, you know, social injustice affects who the bad guys are. I mean, that's really important to understand. But it's very difficult when you're fighting the bad guys and you go around to arrest somebody for horrible offences against vulnerable people, and you're getting screamed at. It's very difficult to realise where that comes from and why they were in that situation in the first place. You know, some of the people I've arrested, you know, we had a team of burglars where I used to work. And if you took them off the streets and put them in prison, the burglary figures would go down by a third. They were so active, you know.
Presumably that's not sustainable, right? Because firstly, they'll be coming out with maybe new skills from the University of Burglary, i.e. prison. And also, it doesn't sort of stop the issues. You know, why, as you say, why are they out there doing these burglaries? And is there a way to reduce crime in a preventative way rather than a reactive way?
Absolutely. I mean, but that is massive, isn't it? That means changing the whole of society, the whole of the value system in society and education, in order to stop the creation of people becoming criminal. I mean, that is a huge thing, but it would be better to change society, clearly, you know.
Do you see that the bad guys in society are different now? And in the sense that they aren't the people who the police can do anything about?
Well, there's a lot of bad guys in government right now. That's who I would like to do something about, because they're not protecting the public and they're deliberately delaying action to counter, you know, the worst threat to humanity, especially when they're corrupt in doing so. And, you know, it seems to be motivated through personal greed. I wasn't that critical of the government before I left the police, I don't think. I was quite critical. I think it all started with the Iraq War, I think was the big one. And realising that we were sending troops out there so that we could have cheaper oil. And then just after that, then you look back at the Falklands War, and then you see that that was about the location of the Falklands and how close it was to Antarctica and the oil reserves under Antarctica, and therefore we have a claim on it. This is all about colonialization and extraction and exploitation of the rest of the world. And that you cannot go on that way. And I think anybody can see that if your whole economy is based on exploitation, that will come to an end. The world is finite and you cannot keep exploiting people forever.
Can you explain the first time you saw corruption in the police force?
And my first detective sergeant who ran the crime squad was corrupt. We were focusing on one particular drugs venue and we were arresting people for supplying drugs. He used to speak to them when they were in custody and then arrange for them to be bailed, and then they would never come back and he would square it up. And it was, that was corruption. So that was my first taste of corruption within the police. And he got moved out. And then luckily we got the next guy that came in was really good, really professional, and changed the entire culture within the team. And, you know, about collecting evidence properly and doing everything by the book. And that was wonderful. And that was a real education, which is what I wanted in the first place, you know. I got a career break to go to Japan to study Aikido. I was studying Aikido anyway, and I wanted to go to Japan to do it while the old master was still alive for 4 years. So I've had an Aikido school here in London, which is just non-profit. Go over to Japan every couple of years to see my teacher, and until I joined XR and then stopped flying. So that's a shame.
Going to Japan must have been incredibly rewarding and helping you to learn these valuable skills. But then coming to the conclusion that you can't fly there anymore must have been a very, very big sacrifice.
Yeah.
So did you suffer any kind of grief at the moment you decided I'm not going to fly anymore?
If the facts are clear, I'm quite practical. It's like, well, this is the case, therefore we have to do that. And I think that's come from police work, really. And the same in Aikido as well. You have to live in the moment. And as the environment is around you, you take that in. And as it changes, you have to change.
I wonder if Aikido, it helped you become adaptable to an ever-changing situation, whether that has helped you to cope with this real uncertainty in the future.
Yeah, I hope so. Unless it's all going to catch up with me and I have a massive breakdown. I mean, that's always a possibility, because there is nothing bigger than what we're facing now. You know, it's not like just failing a martial arts test that you've worked a long time for, or you know.
I would like to know, when you're in the police force, how much of an impact on your career and your day-to-day life do you think that being a tall white male had?
It definitely had a significant effect. I think if you walk into a room of senior officers who are white male predominantly, even if mixed with female officers, if you look the part as a white male copper, and that shouldn't be the case, that you shouldn't look like, you know, white, the stereotypical copper shouldn't look in a particular way. But that was the case when I was in the police. And I knew, and I started to realize that gave me an advantage. You know, if I walk in and say, I've got intelligence that says this, this, and this, we need to do this, this, and this, they would take me more seriously than somebody who wasn't 6'2" and, you know, looked the part. It's an unfortunate thing, I think.
And do you think the culture in the police force has changed since then?
It depends what culture you mean. If you're talking about banter, that definitely changed after Stephen Lawrence. When I joined, I didn't like football. I was more into rugby, but I didn't like football. And I had A-levels, which meant I was gay because I had A-levels and I didn't like football. So, which was banter. That was the kind of culture I was in. They saw me as a little bit weird because I didn't like football. You know, that shows you what it was then. But in 2010, that was completely different. That was a much better... We were recruiting a lot of people with degrees. There was a much higher level of conversation within offices, much more intelligent. Over the next 5-10 years, the banter did change. You know, people did check themselves. They did think a bit more carefully about what they wanted to say, why they couldn't say it, and why they couldn't say it, you know, as in it could offend people and why it might offend people, which was really good. You could see the positive impact. And then right towards the end of my career, I had to look after a black officer who had been racially abused in his team, and he was taking the Met to a tribunal. And I couldn't believe that the Met was still that bad. And that was in 2016, 2017.
Even earlier last week, there was the police watchdog that revealed officers sharing messages about, you know, hitting and raping women and deaths of black babies and the Holocaust. I wonder if that report has contributed to a kind of crisis in confidence in the Met Police and maybe the police overall in Britain. I mean, you mentioned earlier that McPherson inquiry. So just to clarify, that was Stephen Lawrence, black teenager, was murdered waiting for a bus in 1993. That was investigated by the police, but during the investigation of that investigation, there was findings of racism, institutional racism and corruption within the police force. We also have the Sarah Everard case, of course, where she was murdered by a serving police officer, and also the way that the vigil was policed, the reluctance to investigate number 10. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here about whether the public are seeing the police in a different light.
You know, there's 25,000-30,000 officers just in London, and they represent the community they serve. It's not an excuse, but you will always get unsuitable people joining the police. You're giving them power. You're giving them a if you cut the amount of resources going to the police and you're doubling their work, then the people who are recruiting are being told, we need more police and we definitely need more people of a diverse background, whether it's racially diverse or educationally diverse, but we need more people. When I joined, anything with dishonesty, no chance. But that's changed now because they need to recruit more people. So you're getting a more challenging people joining, and the training that you're giving them is less than you used to get because it costs money to train people. They're not on the streets, they're being trained. It's in different forms. So a lot of it is online rather than face to face, where you can actually properly judge people and have a more of a personal impact with people. You know, you need resources in order to challenge it. And it will always be there. There's also a need for people to emotionally express the tension that's built up when you're in violent situations or you're dealing with a horrible death, or the rape of a baby. You know, these things cause trauma, and that's not really recognised. And they don't have the resources to deal with that trauma. So often, and this is not an excuse in any way for bad behaviour, but it contributes. So when people feel that trauma and they know that the institution is not dealing with that and not giving them support, it might say, oh, you know, go onto this website and you can have a chat with someone based somewhere else in the country. You might come and visit in a few weeks' time. That's not proper support. So they feel as though they're not being given support. They feel undervalued. So they don't care when they go and deal with this stuff. It becomes a kind of trench mentality. Another uncle, another violent situation with your mates. It's kind of, well, we can say what we like. We can let off steam. We can do this. We can do that. And then they overstep the bounds of proper communication, which is what's happened.
Do you think that people go into the police because of an inferiority complex? They aren't listened to unless they have a uniform?
Probably. And it is different in uniform. As soon as you put a uniform on, it's not a thrill of power. You feel the perception of the public immediately. And it's not always nice. You spend most of your time knowing who you are and expressing who you are in society. And you look like mostly like everybody else. As soon as you put a uniform on, who you are doesn't count. Everybody sees you as a police officer, and that could be a good thing or a bad thing, but you're definitely not your own person. When you listen to the police talking to protesters, and in some instances, you'll hear them say, right, you've got to go over there now. And they say, oh, right, okay. Why? Why do we have to go over there? So, you know, my role as police liaison is like, sorry, you want us to go over there. So, under what law are you asking us to go over there? And what are you going to do if we don't? You know, and some police officers expect the fact that they've said it has enough authority because it's come out of the mouth of a police officer that people will just do what they're told. You know, and that has to be challenged. That attitude has to be challenged. And I wrote this leaflet to hand to police to show them our justification for doing what we're doing. And I was in Whitehall one day, and it was during the October 2019 rebellion. There was an Asian officer there, and I handed him one of these leaflets, and he pushed it back and he said, no, I don't need that. And I said, why is that? And he said, because I did a degree in ecology and before I joined the police. So I understand about climate change and I understand exactly why you're here. And my family's from Bangladesh and where they live is going to be underwater within 10 years. And I know that as a fact. So I'm completely behind you. It was quite a moving moment, you know, and it's like, okay, you don't need the leaflet then, you know, and it just showed you that the people that were trying to manage our protest, a lot of them are on side. A lot of them understand why we're doing it.
Do you think many police officers really do understand the full urgency and magnitude of the climate crisis?
I think there's a significant portion of them do, yeah. And the ones that I'm in touch with still, from because I only retired in 2018, definitely get it.
But how many police officers do you think, as a proportion perhaps, are sympathetic to Extinction Rebellion and Black Lives Matter and protests in general?
The majority of officers that I chat to as police liaison, some have come up to me and said, what's nice about your speakers is that I always learn something. Scientists or doctors or teachers, I always learn something. But they also have a dilemma with their oath to uphold the law and protect human rights and to act with integrity. They're taking the first one quite literally, uphold the law. But we give them a dilemma where if they uphold the law, they're actually infringing our human rights. So they've got to make that balance. But as people become more and more aware of the climate emergency and more science comes in and more attention is being given to it, how will the police officers feel when their oath is to uphold the law and to protect human rights? And they know that the rights of their children are going to be massively impacted by climate change. And you've got an oil company there that's threatening the lives of their children, but you're being told to uphold the law and stop anybody protesting outside that building. You know, that is a massive dilemma that's going to cause mental health issues. It is going to cause officers a lot of stress when it's between their children and doing what their bosses are telling them to do.
Some of the biggest criminals in the world are legitimate. They're companies like Shell and BP, JP Morgan, Barclays, HSBC. You know, all of these companies are actively destroying human civilization, but it's all legal. Do you think that they should be policed in a different way? And if so, how?
It's worse than what you just said, actually, because we have legislation in this country which obligates them to behave and in that way, which is killing people. You know, so that like the Infrastructure Act of 2015. That tells oil companies that they must maximize the extraction of fossil fuels. So why hasn't this government done something about those that work to support climate breakdown? You know, the laws that we have in place to support that actually pushes climate breakdown have not been repealed. They're still in place. And they put the fossil fuel company CEOs in an impossible position, really. And I have no sympathy for them. But, you know, our government have to get their act together. If they're going to take climate change seriously, they have to get rid of these laws which are pushing in the opposite direction. Don't investigate in drugs, legalise that, deal with it as a health issue, and then put the extra staffing into fighting polluters in this country and have an ecocide unit that is properly functioning and putting people before the courts. Bankers and economists are calling for legislation so that more investment doesn't go into fossil fuels. And at the same time, we've got Rishi Sunak saying that they're not going to put a windfall tax on Shell and BP because they don't want to deter investment, you know, into fossil fuel companies. I mean, that sounds really dodgy to me. That sounds like that's an agreed thing between the Chancellor of the Exchequer and fossil fuel companies.
If you'd like to hear more from people who've reached their tipping point and became environmental activists, earlier on in the series I've spoken with Vickers, a pilot, Olympic athletes, and the comedian Robert Llewellyn off the telly. I wonder what your views are on how protests should be policed. Now, on with the chat with Paul.
You know, the police are coming out in their thousands, and we're peaceful protesters. All you need to do is a bit of traffic management, a couple of contact PCs, you know, PLT. That's it. You know, when the police do overreact, I'm really disappointed in the police. But at the same time, it's like, well, thanks very much. That's going in the media. They're going to love this. So it's kind of it is a dilemma.
XR has a an interesting relationship with police in terms of protesting, because as you're saying, a protest really makes more impact when police are over present.
Yeah.
Even though having a lot of police there in an action might stop things happening in certain ways, what it does do is it helps the primary purpose, which is to get the message out there, because it's more reported.
Absolutely.
So do the police see it that way? Do the police see them that their presence is actually helping the protest?
That's a really good question. I think if they really wanted to scupper it, they would be as soft as possible. But I don't think so. I think it's more Priti Patel is saying, get them off the streets. And they're saying, all right then. And then they overreact. But it's quite funny how it relates to Aikido, because in Aikido, it's completely non-aggressive. So when somebody's attacking you, you deflect and take them off balance. You depend on them attacking you hard to take them off balance. And that's exactly what we do to the police, really. We stand there and say, right, we're going to go in the road now, but we're all peaceful, and you know, we're not going to obstruct you in any way. And then they come out in their hundreds and overreact and overreach. And so it's really similar.
Speaking more about your tipping point, could you explain when that happened and what made you think about joining XR?
One of the things that really got me was a report about coltan in the Congo. It blows your mind, really. So Sony were using militias, but the militias were using children as soldiers to secure coltan to go into Sony PlayStations, so children in the West could play war games. The irony, it's just so horrendous. And obviously I was concerned about pollution and travel. When I was traveling, I'd see masses of pollution around the world and damage, but I'd also see beautiful places. And I don't think I was really aware until about 2017, 2018, about when I retired, the oceans warming. And yeah, so I was quite late.
Well, you say late, I mean, it's difficult to say who your audience is, but maybe there are people listening who really don't know very much about this at all and want to know more. So where do you think that they should go to learn about this stuff?
George Monbiot is very good. He hooked me in very early about the Gulf War, and then about rewilding and sheep farming on mountaintops, you know, destroying the ability to absorb water so that you get more flooding down in the valleys, and various Twitter feeds that I've got of scientists and look at their papers or their articles.
You know, we've got lots of different groups in XR. We've got, you know, XR scientists, XR farmers, all sorts.
Yeah.
Is there an XR police?
No. No. And we're thinking of changing police liaison now. We're thinking of changing the name to Action Contact, because, you know, the fact that we're openly named as police liaison puts a lot of people off, especially from marginalized communities. They look at that and just think, well, why are you being chummy with the police? You know, they're the people who are oppressing me.
Do you have a strategy to get more police involved directly in helping to liaise?
That's quite interesting. So if anything is perceived as subversive, so if it looks like we're trying to encourage police to be involved in something that could be perceived as illegal or disobedient, it's quite a serious thing for the police officer. They could lose their job. And if they reach out to other people in the police, they could lose their job, because it's illegal for police to strike. It's illegal to talk about industrial action. And I've been very careful with the police officer that I know not to approach them in that way, because I know that they would feel compromised immediately. You go your way, I'll go my way. I'm not going to do that to them.
Why would the police be looking for information on protests? Why isn't their function just to react to a protest that's happening?
You'd hope so, but we cost them 50 million. Was it 50 million, I think, in the first couple of years in policing bills? So if they can get the heads up and put a stop to it with preemptive tactics, it saves them a lot of money. And it also saves them embarrassment, because they, you know, dealing with XR specifically, there is the chance they look silly.
You've been reading a book at the moment on the role of the police in the future and whether we could live in a society without police at all. What are your views on that?
it's a real chicken and the egg, isn't it? If society is capable of changing because of the threat of the climate emergency, then it is possible. I think every religion has something like love your neighbor or love others, love your enemy. Every religion has that in there. Has anybody actually managed to do it? I don't think so. But that's what we need to do in a society to deal with the climate emergency. And that's what we need to do if we're not going to have any police. We've got a massive, massive inequality now. We always have, but it's bigger now than probably it ever has been before. And, you know, if you want to reduce police, at the moment, if you reduce police, you're just going to get worse police because they've got more to do with less people and they're going to behave worse. So in order to reduce police, the society has to be less unequal. Citizens' assemblies are another big thing for improving equality.
I wonder, kind of looking into the future, when I say when, because I do feel that there's an inevitability about it, but when there's huge civil unrest and mass migration and food shortages, what would the role of the police be in that future world?
Yeah, how it starts initially, I mean, with this government, it's more authoritarian. You can see they've done that already. And if you look at what the government's doing now, I can't believe anything that's said in Parliament. You know, it has to be fact. Everything has to be fact checked. There is no trust there whatsoever. So it is not looking good. If our government carries on this way, then it would be authoritarian, I think.
Is there a danger in the future of the police becoming more brutal if there is mass civil unrest with huge mass migration and food shortages in an environment like that? Do you think that there might be emergency responses from government to say police can now be brutal, police can now carry firearms?
Yeah, of course it's possible. Yeah, absolutely. I think the one thing we've got in our favour, though, is that Extinction Rebellion has been telling the truth right from the beginning, and police officers have been coming to their protests and listening to what XR have been saying. So if the social unrest is coming, the police officers will be able to see that what's happening is what we foretold in the first place, you know?
Some amendments to the Police Crime and Sentencing and Courts Bill, or the PCSE Bill, is a worry for many, but what's your main concern?
We had a really interesting meeting with Professor Stephen Riker, a psychologist on crowds. He's on the radio quite a bit, contributing with regard to COVID management. One of the things that he said that is most apparent, as dialogue with authority, the police, decreases, the likelihood of violence increases, which is so simple and so obvious. And when you look at what this government has done with policing, it has been decreasing dialogue all the way through to the PCSE bill, which is going to increase violence.
The final questions I've got are more about you personally. What has the XR given you?
The first thing it gave me was hope. I walked through Oxford Circus. There was the pink boat. I thought the human race was too greedy to survive on this planet. There were 1,000 people there with a samba band and who cared in the same way I did. That there was a chance to change. Maybe this is it. So I've got to give it a go. I've got to give it a go. If there's this many people that feel the same way, then I've got to help in whatever way I can. Tears. I can't help being moved when I see things happening, actions, you know. When I see sacrifice, when I see people speaking sometimes, when I see the Red Brigade, that's really moving, I think. And when I've seen the Red Brigade standing there in front of a line of police in Millbank, and the police were clearing the street and they were just like pushing people on. They were using Section 3 Criminal Law Act, which means you can use force to stop an offence like highway obstruction. So they were legally pushing people down Millbank. And then the Red Brigade just stood there in a line and the police stopped and they looked at each other for 20 minutes. There's a woman wearing face paint in a red dress, and that's enough to stop you carrying out your duty. You idiot, you know. But it was profoundly moving because they were completely peaceful and just stared them in the eye, person to person.
How about fatigue? When something's an emergency, things need to happen quickly. But you've been involved in this for so long that there's a possibility of emergency fatigue. Has that been something you've experienced?
When your action support, which police liaison is, you go all day with a march and then an action, and then somebody locks on and they might be there all night. So then it's like, how long do you stay there for? You can't go 24 around the clock. You then need a shift pattern. But if you didn't know that was going to happen, there isn't a shift pattern prepared. So you have to kind of leave them, which is quite tiring, and then come back the next day. But it's more, the thing that gets me is the every day looking at what's happening in the news, what's happening in Parliament, what's happening worldwide, looking at the damage, that wears you down because you just feel that you have to be on top of it all the time, not having a break. And I think regen, when we started, was a really important thing that was pushed, you know, because I think many people in XR are not behaving in a way which is sustainable. They're doing it because everything is so urgent, which will burn out. And I've known lots of people that have burnt out. And you really have to be disciplined. And thankfully, that's one thing I learned in the police. Like on murder squads, you tend to work around the clock. Sometimes you do 48 hours, 72 hours without going to bed. But then if you've got a good boss, you'll say, I don't want to see you for 2 days. Well, I don't want to see you for a day. Just go to bed and come back refreshed. But you have to be disciplined to look after yourself, because if your health is affected, then you're not going to be effective.
It's interesting. So your martial arts and your career both helped you with that discipline. And I wonder if that has been a part of the reason why you haven't experienced this fatigue or this burnout that other people have had.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think it probably has been helpful. Yeah. I think it's really unfashionable because you have to be a bit selfish to do that. Maybe I take to that quite easily. And, you know, you have to be a little bit selfish. You have to say, I'm going to have a weekend off, or I'm going to have a week off here. Like for me, because I'm of a certain age, I cannot view every single group on the phone that I'm in. I'm not going to monitor every single message that comes through because I'm on about 30 different, 40 different groups. I could if my phone was there for the whole day, and I know people who are close to me who do that. And I don't think it's a life that I want and that I can sustain. I do it once a day, twice a day, and look at, see what messages have come through. That's it.
So once a day, you look at your 80 messages, do you? That would take 2 hours.
And I look really carefully at them as well.
What do you hope the future will look like? Do you have a picture of what that might be? And how do you think we could get there?
That's such a difficult question, isn't it? More damage is going to be done to the planet, obviously, because we're just not meeting the targets. And it's going to, even if we stopped everything, then it would still be continuing until it tapered off for a few decades. But we're really at a crossroads. Well, it's probably 80-20, 20% chance that we go the right way and 80% chance that we go the wrong way because of greed or misinformation or the fact that we have to work together. It's definitely possible that we can change. It's just that young people who have been like born within the era of mobile phones, maybe, or definitely cars, and well, I was born with cars. You think, you take them as read, this is life, this is the world. But I think when you start looking at history, it's not. It's a very, very, very small part that where we've gone wrong. And when I chatted to my dad, who designed oil refineries, before he died, he said, yeah, we thought it was a good thing at the beginning. We were driving massive innovation in industry, you know, to make life better and for hospitals and civilization and to decrease death rates. You know, that would, the oil industry was a good thing in his mind up to a certain point. And then it became apparent that it wasn't. And I think there was a period of delusion in the middle where he was being told that it wasn't by some people and told that it was by the oil industry. And he was making his living that way. My third eye is not giving me any strong readings at the moment. And it's such an obvious thing for people to think about. We cannot go on exploiting our planet because it is finite. I mean, anybody can understand that if they take the time to understand it. My job now is to get out there on doorsteps and talk to people. And I think a lot of XR need to be doing that now. As long as they're not in too dire a situation with the cost of living, because, you know, just one more thing to worry about is not going to go down well with the people if they're on the breadline. But at the moment, they seem to be quite rightly blaming the government because they're the ones that have gotten to this position.
And with that, Paul Stevens, thank you very much.
Pleasure. It was a real pleasure talking to you, Pete.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project. We communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.